It's spooky season, friends. We're already halfway through October. The inevitable passage of time is the spookiest thing out there. Torch Cabinet has now been on YouTube for a whole year, and I have a rather different Halloween episode this time around. I will be getting some noise-absorbing panels in my apartment here, and you will hear their impact on the next video, but for now, they're being sent to me. I'm getting settled in my New York apartment. I'm still perfecting my studio setup, and for just one more episode, you get to enjoy the vintage Torch Cabinet janky audio. Both my last two episodes were recorded here in New York too, but my previous episode about Lin Biao had way, way worse audio than my previous episode about the mysterious color Qing. Took me a second to realize it was because of the original background behind me reflecting noise, so I'm back to the blue screen for this episode only. Once I've got the panels, I can bring back the classic background. So yeah, this is my Halloween episode, but it's not the entry into the Halloween canon you may expect. That's not to say it's not spooky, it's plenty spooky. In this episode, you'll learn how to pray to a Mayan incarnation of the devil, and learn the official Catholic word for a headless guy carrying his living head along. But its connection to Halloween is more conceptual. As you may know, the word Halloween is a contraction of All Hallows' Eve, meaning the day before All Hallows' Day, meaning All Saints' Day, November 1st. That's the official fall holiday in the Christian calendar. Traditionally, and this is still a thing in Catholic countries, every day of the year commemorates some saint or other, and maybe if your town or even just your family has a patron saint who has a particular feast day, you'd have a feast or a party on that day, but that day wouldn't be a holiday to anyone else. November 1st is for all the other saints who don't get their own day. Then it became a tradition in Europe to celebrate the dead on the day before All Saints' Day, which led into celebrations of the macabre and local legends that demons and ghosts and vengeful spirits would rise from hell on that night, and you had to dress up in wacky costumes to scare them back, and gradually that overtook the solemn official holiday that All Hallows' Eve was supposed to lead into. Specific Halloween traditions like jack-o'-lanterns were introduced by Irish immigrants to America from the related Celtic festival of Samhain, although pumpkins are an American thing, and back in bonny old Ireland, they carved turnips. I love Halloween, but I'm kind of bummed that its connection to All Saints' Day has mostly been forgotten in the secular West. I think it would be fun to re-add some kind of commemoration of saints into our modern Halloween. It wouldn't feel as jarring as you might think to celebrate the obscure saints alongside goblins, ghosts, and ghouls, because there are some really weird saints. What defines a saint? Like almost anything else in Christianity, that varies a lot depending on whose denomination you ask. Only some of them officially recognize saints. The Eastern Orthodox churches can declare historical figures to be saints in a process called glorification, although Eastern Orthodox Christianity is made up of several autocephalous, meaning independent, Eastern Orthodox churches, like Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Bulgarian Orthodox, etc. Sometimes they're all on good terms with each other and recognize they all practice the same religion. Sometimes they don't, like right now, the Russian Orthodox Church is not popular among the rest of the Orthodoxes because Putin has a lot of power over the Russian Church, and either way, each one's list of saints varies. Most Protestant sects say that everyone who goes to heaven is a saint, and anyone who faithfully follows their sect goes to heaven, so you don't have to be special to be a saint. The goal is for everyone to be a saint. Usually in the West, though, when you refer to a saint, you mean a Catholic saint, because the Roman Catholic Church has the most autistically detailed process for naming, categorizing, and worshiping saints. Being named a Catholic saint is called canonization and can only be done by the Pope. There are many lower levels of blessings that a person has to go through before they can be considered for canonization, with the titles Servant of God, Venerable, and Blessed added in that order. And when they get to the step of finally having saint added to their name, they get subjected to a hearing almost like a Supreme Court nomination for someone who's dead, where a board known as the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints presents arguments for and against, and details from their life are brought up to determine if they were sufficiently holy. In order to be canonized, you obviously have to be dead, because if you're still alive with your free will, there's always the chance that you'll fuck up and do something unsaintly after you've been canonized. But you also have to have performed at least two well-documented miracles, something that would be impossible without divine intervention, and the Vatican requires a strong standard of evidence for what constitutes a miracle. There are official Catholic Mythbusters, basically. most purported miracles they investigate are ruled to be not that miraculous. This is something I'd love to make a whole episode about. There are people in the Catholic Church who investigate miracles from a genuine perspective of scientific skepticism with the mental model that divine miracles are a thing that can happen, but they're extremely rare, and this probably isn't one. For example, Mother Teresa wasn't canonized until 20 years after her death because the Vatican didn't believe the stories of healing miracles associated with her, and when her case was finally presented before the Pope, they invited Christopher Hitchens, a libertarian atheist journalist who'd written a book convincingly arguing that Mother Teresa was not that saintly at all, to speak against Teresa's canonization. They take criticism of would-be saints remarkably seriously. This is a much stricter requirement than any other sect puts on sainthood. For example, the Armenian Orthodox Church has declared all victims of the Armenian Genocide to be saints, which the Catholics wouldn't be able to do. No miracles, no sainthood. The Pope can, of course, technically do whatever he wants, and a few times a saint who's been locally venerated for hundreds of years but never got officially canonized has been canonized just like that by the Pope without the whole process, but normally you need a miracle. The whole formal, detailed canonization process has gradually come into being over the past 1,000 years, which is just half of the Catholic Church's history. Before just the 17th century, it was much easier to become a saint, and before the 1100s, local bishops had the power to name saints without the Pope's approval. As a result, we don't know how many Catholic saints there are. There are plenty of locally venerated saints where we don't know for sure if any pope ever canonized them. The current estimate is that there are around 11,000 Catholic saints. Because of the concept of patron saints, that every saint has a place, occupation, or concept that is their dominion, and you can pray to them for intervention on that issue, some other Christian sects have claimed that Catholicism is not truly monotheistic, it's polytheistic. And surprisingly, some scholars of religion agree. In religious studies, you'll often hear a claim that Hinduism has tens of thousands of gods, most of which are only worshipped by one village or even just one family at a single temple. What difference is there between that and the tens of thousands of Catholic saints, some canonized by the Vatican, others just figures of local folklore? The combination of local folklore, oddities of the wildly different culture of medieval Europe, and the requirement of performing miracles leads to some pretty fantastic accounts of saints and their miracles. Here are 9 of the most fun saint stories me and my co-writer Nick Miller could find. Be aware before we proceed, I made up one of these stories. Try to guess which one it is, but if you want to comment with your guess, hide the spoiler behind a bunch of paragraph breaks. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Thimble the Doll and Sluds the Shoggoth. Jollibee will be back next week, and welcome to a spooktacular, yet holy, episode of Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Before we continue, I'd like to do something that I haven't done in quite a while on here, a fan art roundup. Fitting with this episode's Halloween theme, Baby Bones has drawn me looking like Frankenstein's monster. Excellent. Nice username, I guess. Has done Jollibee in subpixels on a Pixel 9 screen taken at 40 times magnification with a Pixel 7. This is awesome. Top Code has made the ESP30 tour. And speaking of unexpected media, we've got this origami Jollibee, Husalino, and various other trinkets by the Arson Bird, posted by my ever-so-helpful manager, Jim. Storm has depicted me disrobing in the Neelix video, hot, as well as a terrific cartoon Jollibee, and here I am depicted by Goji with a Jollibee Obey shirt. JDU apparently stands for Jollibee the Durian University. Want to submit some fan art? Join the Tor's Cabinet Discord, which you get access to by joining the Tor's Cabinet Patreon. Link in description. There's a whole fan art channel. Might take me a minute to feature your art, but I always will. Want to buy some fan art? You can do that too, in the Tor store! We do not have Jollibee the Durian Obey shirts yet, but we do have Jollibee Vaporwave shirts, this fantastic design by Captain Caps Lock, mugs, posters, mouse pads, and more. Link in the description or in the pinned comment. There are patron saints of everything. Some contrarian in the back of the class is gonna go, oh, even murderers? According to some sources, even murderers. And he's a big deal. Saint Julian is a venerated saint within the Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodox Church. He's the patron saint of the cities of Ghent, Belgium, St. Julian's, Malta, and Macerata, Italy, of ferrymen, of innkeepers, and purportedly, murderers. Julian lived so far back, we're not sure if he was a real person, nor where he was born. Accounts range from Le Mans, France, to Ath, Belgium, to Naples in Italy. The main story of his life comes from The Golden Legend by the 13th century Archbishop of Genoa, Jacobus de Varennes. This was one of the main compilations of hagiographies, that is, saint biographies, and it was the medieval equivalent of Corbin Blue's Wikipedia page in that it was translated into the second most languages of any book at the time, after only the Bible. They didn't have Obama yet, so The Golden Legend couldn't be third behind Jesus and Obama. Once the printing press went mainstream, everyone literate had a Bible and a Golden Legend. Sometimes a different book of hagiographies under the same title, because Golden Legend kind of became a genericized trademark, like how every tissue is called a Kleenex. The first English language edition of Varenne's Golden Legend was published in 1438, cryptically credited to a sinful wretch, spelled as medievally as possible, but in 1483 it became one of the first books published by William Caxton, who brought the printing press to England. Varenne's account of the life of St. Julian goes as follows. When he was born, he was cursed by witches to kill his parents. Like any good folktale protagonist, Julian spent his youth trying to avoid the terrible thing he was fated to do. He left his family at just 10 to protect his loving parents by getting as far away from them as possible. He walked for 50 days until he reached Galicia, probably the region of northwest Spain, although there's also a historic region of Ukraine and Poland called that, and which Galicia Julian ended up in probably varies depending on where in Europe his story was told. There he married a Galician woman and had a decent life, hoping for their sake that he was away from his parents for good. Around Julian's 30th birthday, of course, his parents went out searching for him. They came to his village and prayed in the local church, where they met a woman who they asked for a place to stay the night. The woman said they could stay in her house, in her bed, because her husband, Julian, was out hunting and probably would be out all night. After some more questions, it turned out that yes, she was married to the same Julian they were looking for. They were overjoyed to find that their son had found a good life. Of course, you know what happens next. Julian came back early from hunting to find an unfamiliar couple in his bed. In the low light, he thought it was his wife sleeping with another man, and he drew his sword, I guess he was hunting with a sword, and killed them both. When he stepped out of the house and saw his pious wife returning from church, he asked her who had been sleeping in their bed. When she revealed it was his parents, he was so stricken by grief that he vowed on the spot to devote his life to Jesus, and specifically to help travelers make the pilgrimage to Rome, which is where he got the epithet Julian the Hospitaller, as in someone who provides hospitality, and how he became the patron saint of innkeepers and ferrymen. Interestingly, the part about him being cursed by witches, the part that makes this feel like a thousands of years old folktale or a Greek tragedy about the inevitability of fate, was most likely added on by Jacobus de Varennes in The Golden Legend. Previous accounts of St. Julian's life say that he just loved his parents and set out on his own later in life before he made the same disastrous mistake. There's a completely different legend that may or may not refer to the same St. Julian. That's another reason we're not sure how many total saints there are, because there are plenty of saints with the same name and plenty of monks writing hagiographies who confused them and lumped their stories together. But there's another legend that might refer to our same St. Julian later in life when he was an innkeeper for pilgrims. The devil disguised himself as a weary pilgrim and entered his inn, then just trashed the place, causing such a mess that Julian, upon waking up and seeing the mess the devil had caused, kicked out all the pilgrims, not knowing who was responsible. Then Jesus showed up at his door, also disguised as a weary pilgrim, and Julian initially turned him away, worried that he would also trash the place, but then, somehow, Julian realized who the man was and let him in, certifying his saintly status. I love legends like that, where the devil shows up and he's just annoying. That's how he reveals that he's the embodiment of evil. He just acts like a normal human being who is a jerk ass. Also, It's not actually clear if Julian the Hospitaller is the patron saint of murderers. Plenty of interesting facts blogs and Reddit posts and stuff recount this story going, wow, there's a patron saint of murderers? But I can find no official Catholic source claiming this. He's definitely better known within the church as the patron saint of travelers and innkeepers. I think the idea that he's the patron saint of murderers is just folklore, but everything here is just folklore. You know what? Sure, murderers get a saint. But that makes some sense, right? The patron saint of murderers is someone who murdered people in a fit of rage that he came to regret and repent for. He's the patron saint for murderers who regret it. He's not like someone you can pray to for good luck out murdering. Are there saints like that? Saints whose domain is explicitly over something evil? Not if you ask the Vatican, of course, but in terms of local veneration, yes, there absolutely are. Jesus Malverde was born Jesus Juarez Matzo Campos on December 24, 1870, in Sinaloa, a poor coastal state of Mexico, infamous today as the home of the Sinaloa Cartel, one of the most powerful organized crime outfits in the world. Like many much older saints, stories of Malverde's life vary a lot, but what's agreed upon is that he never himself dealt drugs. Nevertheless, he became known as the most popular, but not the only, narco saint. Narco saints are a blend of Spanish Catholic and Mesoamerican traditions, revering figures that, for obvious reasons, have not been canonized by the Catholic Church. The legend of Jesus Malverde was that after his parents died of either hunger or a curable illness, he turned to banditry within Sinaloa. He became seen as a local Robin Hood figure, nicknamed El Malverde, the Green Evil, because he operated out of forests within the Sierra Madre Mountains. One version of his legend is that Malverde was challenged by the governor of Sinaloa, Francisco Canedo, to steal his daughter or his sword in return for a pardon. Malverde stole the governor's sword and wrote on the wall of the governor's mansion, Jesus M. was here. The governor never thought he'd actually do it, the absolute madman, and ordered Malverde to be hanged. Malverde was eventually caught and executed. To make an example to the bandits scurrying around the state, the governor refused Malverde a proper burial and left his corpse to be hanging till his bones fell to the ground. It is believed he was executed in 1909. Those who venerate Malverde are the underclass of Sinaloa and northern Mexico. Most of the offerings for him come from drug lords, which are used to then get wheelchairs and crutches for those who need it. Or if a family cannot afford a casket, that money goes to helping the family out. This is how the cartels hold on to power in some parts of rural Mexico, by acting as Robin Hood figures, providing poor families with a limited social safety net. Plenty of people trust the cartels to look after them better than the government. Like many of the earlier saints, Malverde's story is local folklore, and there's no evidence that he ever really existed. Folk saint worship among the narcotraficantes is reported to have started in the 1970s with the Sinaloan drug baron Julio Escalante and his son Raimundo. Although, Malverde was already a local legend at that point who had shrines and was treated as a saint. After Julio ordered the execution of a rival, the dying man prayed for rescue to Malverde and supposedly survived the shooting. The narco dollars brought a lot of money and infrastructure to the state of Sinaloa, and nowadays, images of Malverde are seen by police as a sign of involvement in the drug trade, though some Sinaloans reject this and say he's just a figure of local pride. Malverde's holy days are said to be Monday, his birthday, and Saturday, his death day. His effigies tend to include a rosary, a crucifix, and a cowboy hat. But there are older folk saints in Mexico and Central America, ones that harken back to pre-Christian traditions, ones that aren't necessarily associated with criminality, but are even less popular with the mainstream Catholic Church. Andrew Chestnut, a professor of religious studies at Virginia Commonwealth University, says Mexican botanicas, which are esoterica shops, cabinets of curiosities, you might say, sell more Santa Muerte figurines than they do icons of the Virgin of Guadalupe, Mexico's patron saint. Santa Muerte has a reputation for being an incredibly speedy and efficacious miracle worker, says Chestnut, describing her as a healer and a whiz at solving legal problems. And, unlike most canonized saints, at the end of the day, she isn't Catholic, so you can ask her for anything. To bless a shipment of crystal meth, for example. Santa Muerte looks like a skeletonized Virgin Mary, and yes, her name does mean Saint Death. She's generally seen as a combination of Mictlantecuhtli, the Aztec goddess of death, with the Virgin Mary. She is not evil. She's a psychopomp, which means soul guider, that is, someone who helps a dying person transition from this world to the next. Nearly every religion has a psychopomp figure. In some ways, Santa Muerte is analogous to the Grim Reaper. He's a psychopomp too, and he's an interesting character in Western folklore. The Reaper is not a religious figure. Most of the cultures that Grim Reaper imagery comes from are Christian, but no Christian sect preaches that the Grim Reaper literally exists the way they say God does. The Grim Reaper is probably inspired by Charon, the ferryman who takes people to the ancient Greek underworld, but no Christian sect has integrated this pre-Christian folk figure into actual religious practice. The psychopomp in Christianity who you're supposed to believe in is typically Saint Peter. Whereas in Mexico, rank-and-file Catholics, though not the official church leadership, have made a pre-Christian Grim Reaper-like figure into a Catholic saint that people who consider themselves Catholic can pray to. Psychopomp is also just a really fun word, and is the title of the debut album by Japanese Breakfast, who went to my high school. Santa Muerte is also a queer icon, because like drug trafficking or worshipping Santa Muerte, being queer is something frowned on by Mexico's mainstream Catholic Church, but plenty of queer Mexicans still consider themselves Catholic, and if they can't pray for protection from anyone church-approved, they'll pray to a folk Catholic figure instead. The worship of Santa Muerte has increasingly developed into its own religion, sometimes considered the biggest new religious movement in the Americas, but she still retains her equal parts Catholic and Aztec trappings. Down in Guatemala, there's another figure like her, Maximón, another folk deity formed from a merger of Mayan and Catholic tradition. The worship of Maximón is believed to have begun during the time of the Spanish conquest of the Maya. He wasn't a pre-existing Mayan god. He was created in the period of massive upheaval brought by the conquistadors as a combination of several different Mayan and Catholic folkloric figures. It's pretty common for a colonized people to begin converting en masse to something like a syncretic local version of their colonizers' religion, with the mindset that, well, worshipping their god seems to be working out well for them. The Chinese equivalent of this was the pseudo-Christian Taiping Rebellion. Check out that episode. Or don't. Keep watching this one. The Catholics gave Maximón the name of Saint Simon, and in Santiago Atitlan, a lakeside town in central Guatemala where Maximón is considered the local patron saint, his effigy rotates being housed in different houses of his followers. He is given gifts of tobacco, rum, and money. To Catholics, he is seen as a merger of a satanic figure like Judas, or a link to the conquistador Pedro de Alvarado. Others believe he could be a mixture of the Mayan Earth Lord Mam and the Apostle Simon Peter, Jesus' first disciple. One worshiper of Maximón, Dolores Ratzan, did not see him as a competing figure with Jesus, telling NBC News in 2017, "No, they are not competing. They go together, because the celebration of Jesus to the Mayans represents the corn, like Jesus' resurrection. And then Maximón is like the Mayan protector with whom my ancestors left their knowledge, their medicine, and their prayers. So Maximón is the holy grandfather who follows Jesus like father and son. It's not competing. They are working together." In Guatemala's folk traditions, Jesus is associated with the Mayan corn god. His resurrection is likened to the return of the corn harvest every year. Felipe Coche, an administrator for the Catholic Church of Santiago, said that the Mayan tradition of Maximón has nothing to do with the Catholic Church. The church completely rejects this. Father Hugo Estrada told the Guatemalan newspaper Prensa Libre that he's the devil. Abelardo Ruiz Perez, a leader of the Archdiocese of Solala, also views the worship of Maximón by the indigenous Guatemalans as satanic, saying that Maximón is a phenomenon of the gravest religious corruption. Only God may know the destruction of souls and bodies. The church sees his worship as witchcraft. They have reason for considering Maximón's worship to be satanic. His supporters, although they consider themselves Catholic, don't necessarily disagree that Maximón is associated with the devil. The Oración del Puro, prayer of purity or prayer of the cigar, which is used for protection, goes, "I conjure you pure in the name of Satan, Luzbel, and Lucifer. Dogs bark, cats howl, children cry, and thus as you conquered the heart of your father and your mother, thus you have conquered the heart of Tor. For me, so that I will go singing through all regions until the seventh region." That's a very pre-Christian aspect of Maximón's worship. He is divine, but that does not necessarily mean he's good. The doctrine of God and the devil, that there's one deity who's purely good, who you have to pray to, and one deity who's purely bad, who you definitely shouldn't pray to, is pretty unique to Abrahamic, Middle Eastern, in origin religions. far more common is to have a polytheistic religion in which the gods and spirits are powerful and can protect you if you pray to them, but have complex human-like personalities and definitely aren't infallible. When the conquistadors introduced the Mayans to Christianity, it seems a lot of them were like, "What do you mean we can't pray to Satan? He's powerful, right? Probably could protect you if you prayed to him, right? Of course he's evil. Jesus has probably done bad shit too, right?" Pilgrims to Santiago Atitlan leave Maximon offerings of rum, bread, cigars, money, and Guatemala's national alcoholic drink, Quetzalteca. His worship has been declining due to the rise of evangelical Christianity, which has been gaining converts from both Catholicism and pre-Christian traditions all across Latin America in the 21st century, but there's still a strong base of support for Maximon in Santiago Atitlan and its area. Due to the endemic issues of poverty, corruption, and violence in Guatemala, Maximon serves as a powerful force for people to call out to for help. You can't trust the government to keep you safe, but maybe you can trust your neighbors to do that. And if that's the case, why trust the national church's God over your neighbor's God? Marcos Lopez explained to Prensa Libre why many are afraid to get rid of their personal statues of Maximon. True or not, here it is thought that if you cease to worship, it can bring misfortune. Others believe that nothing will happen. To be secure, it is better to leave him in peace. When I embarked on this episode, I had two questions in mind. Is there a Saint Tor, and is there a patron saint of autism? There are a lot of saints. It's conceivable one of those probably exists, right? The answer still managed to surprise me. Is there a Saint Tor? Sort of. Is there a patron saint of autism? Also sort of, and it's the same guy. Saint Thorlak is one of those saints I talked about earlier who has been part of local tradition for hundreds of years but was only recently canonized by the Pope because he's not heretical like Maximon, he just lived in a rather obscure place, a country with roughly the population of Knox County, Tennessee, a unique and fascinating place that rarely crosses the minds of anyone but volcano enthusiasts and shark blubber eaters. Iceland. Of course the patron saint of autism would live in Iceland, you know? Not only are Nordic people the most introverted culture on Earth, I feel like Iceland is sort of the ultimate nerd vacation destination. When going to Japan became too mainstream, every 2010s nerd fantasized about going to Iceland. Saint Thorlak was born in 1133, back before the Protestant Reformation. Iceland definitely isn't a Catholic country anymore. It was, of course, long before autism was classified too, and nobody can be sure what was really going on in Thorlak's mind, but when autistic Catholics, a surprisingly robust demographic, promote Saint Thorlak as their patron, I definitely see where they're coming from. Born to an illiterate peasant family in medieval Iceland, he taught himself to read from a very young age, and would incorrigibly wander around his and his neighbors' farms, asking people strikingly deep questions. Iceland at this time was a truly unique place. It had no king, and its only government was an outfit called the Althing, which every male head of household was automatically a member of. Every year, nearly everyone in the sparsely populated country would convene in Thingvellir, the Valley of the Althing, and vote on creating or amending laws. The Althing gradually evolved into a professional legislature and is still the name of Iceland's parliament, making it the oldest continuing government in the world, although the country has changed enough that I'm dubious it deserves that title. I've even heard claims that medieval Iceland could be described as anarcho-capitalist. In Thorlak's time, the main instrument of law was the lawsuit. The most powerful people in the country were the best lawyers, and if a member of your family got murdered because they accidentally insulted another family's honor, which happened all the time, your response would have to be to hire a good lawyer and sue the other family. If you won, they would pay a weregild, a fixed sum of money that was the main way people were punished for crimes. It sure wasn't a utopia, but it sure was unique. Young Thorlak wanted none of this. He avoided large gatherings and anywhere people were talking too loud. He followed the Bible rigidly, to the word, seeing the world in terms of absolutes. He was extremely smart, becoming one of the first Icelanders to go study the Bible in France and England as a teenager, and he could be engaged in hours of intense conversation about theology, but intense conversation about theology seemed to be the only thing he ever enjoyed, and when asked about other things, he would often barely even respond. People would seek Thorlak out as something of a sage, which he liked, but he had few close personal connections. He never married and recited specific prayers at specific times of day throughout his life. In other words, Thorlak was a perfect saint. The miracles attributed to him are fairly dull, bog-standard stuff like calming a storm at sea, healing a leper, and in the most Icelandic miracle of all, healing a horse that had burned its hooves by running through hot volcanic soil. He was officially canonized in 1984, after centuries of being revered in his home country. Today, he's officially the patron saint of Iceland, unofficially the patron saint of autism, and although Iceland is no longer Catholic, he's still widely celebrated. December 23rd is Thorleik's feast day. Traditions commemorating Saint Thorleik have been integrated into Icelandic Christmas celebrations, including eating skate, you know, a big flat fish like a stingray, that has been buried and fermented until it begins to smell like ammonia. Ladies and gentlemen, Iceland. History is silent on whether Thorleik enjoyed fermented skate. Maybe he did. Maybe that was one of his safe foods. I won't judge. But he'd probably politely excuse himself from all the drinking and caroling. If autism has a patron saint, do other mental conditions? Well, the Catholic Church has officially named a patron saint of the intellectually disabled, and boy was he interesting. Joseph of Cupertino is a great story. Compared to some of the other saints in this episode, he lived relatively recently, or at least recently enough that there's plenty of surviving firsthand documentation of him, and his signature miracle was pretty damn miraculous. Some serious theologians have pointed to Joseph of Cupertino as having the strongest evidence of any saint of a truly divine miracle. See, Joseph of Cupertino could fly. Sometimes known by the epithet Joseph the Dunce, Joseph of Cupertino was born in 1603 in southern Italy. He was reasonably well-functioning, but he could not follow orders or do anything that required fine motor skills. Historians debate how intellectually disabled he was, and I think it's conceivable that he, like Thorleik, was autistic and intelligent with a special interest in the Bible and theology. He was unable to learn a trade, and when he turned 18, his mother handed him over to a local Franciscan monastery, hoping they would take care of him. To everyone's surprise, it seemed to be the first and only place where he was happy and comfortable. There, he began flying. There are hundreds of known accounts from at least 150 different people of Joseph of Cupertino's tendency to leap up into the air at random times and stay there. The monks initially considered this to simply be annoying. Joseph was shuttled around from monastery to monastery, each one trying and failing to deal with his highly distracting hovering habit. Of course, rumors began to spread, a following began to grow, and according to a book about him, The Man Who Could Fly, quote, "We find reports from every town and city in Italy where Joseph resided. People swore they observed him aloft in Grotella, Assisi, Rome, Naples, Perugia, Osimo, Fossombrone, and Pietrarubia, in churches, convents, and conventinos, all over Italy. Wherever he went, it created a sensation and left a trail of haunted, aroused seekers, not aroused in that way, I hope, who wanted, often desperately, to see, touch, or consult with him. People from all walks of life were affected, some very distinguished, like John Casimir Vasa, a spiritual son of Joseph who became the King of Poland, the Duke of Brunswick, the employer of calculus co-inventor Gottfried Leibniz, and the passionately spiritual Infanta Maria, the Princess of Savoy, in the end rebuffed by Joseph. Nobody in Joseph's time seemed to deny that he could fly. As the passage I quoted suggests, aristocrats and high-ranking church figures showed up at the monasteries where Joseph lived, either expecting to witness a miracle or, in the case of some of them, debunk a miracle. Nobody could. He was accused of witchcraft and put on trial. Both the prosecution and defense agreed Joseph could fly. The matter at hand was whether he flew because of God or because of the devil. He levitated inside, outside, dancing in midair or kneeling in prayer a few feet off the ground, sometimes dragging other people up into the air with him, but acting clearly encumbered when he did, rising slower and lower. Clearly his levitating force was not infinite. At one point, he flew up to the roof of a specific church to hug the statue of Virgin Mary on the steeple, nearly 100 feet high. Internal church documents reveal friars discussing how to deal with this miracle on their hands. Of course, skeptics have done their best. Joe Nickel of the Skeptical Inquirer claims that Joseph of Cupertino was really just an acrobat. His flights were really leaps, impressive, but not supernatural. For the incident where he levitated up to the top of the steeple, Nickel suggests he really just dexterously climbed the steeple like a mountain goat in a series of leaps. Others have proposed that his flights were hallucinations brought on by ergot, a fungus that grows on wheat with effects similar to LSD, but I doubt that that could cause so many people to have the same exact hallucination of the same specific guy flying. Seems that whenever something purportedly supernatural happened in pre-modern times or the global south, there's always an ergot theory, and while I don't know what it's actually like to experience ergot, I feel like, you know, that always feels like a what people who have never done drugs think drugs do to you kind of theory. The strongest evidence I think there is against Joseph of Cupertino literally supernaturally flying is that there are other stories of flying saints, some of which are very similar and much older and harder to verify. This is a trope that extends beyond this guy, and the other stories are a good deal less reliable. Legend and reality could have accidentally mixed up over the years, even in people who swore up and down that they once saw Joseph take flight. Either way, I don't really know what to make of Joseph of Cupertino, but the Catholic Church has declared him the patron saint of intellectual disability and, more recently, aviation. Next time you're getting off a plane, tell the pilot that those things have the same patron saint. Another interesting aspect of the Joseph of Cupertino story is that some accounts say he himself didn't really enjoy his miraculous ability. Sometimes he would yelp and leap backward into the air, seemingly being tugged by some invisible force that he wasn't in control of. That every now and then the Holy Spirit would call on him and he'd be like, all right, time to float up to the rafters. Are there other saints like this? People who, according to the official hagiographies, basically had a superpower, but they saw it as a curse? There's this great one from medieval Wales. We're returning to the golden legend for this one. According to our friend Jacobus de Voren, Aneurin of Anglesey was an 11th century Welsh abbot who could talk to animals. If you thought this would make him an empathetic friend of nature, think again. He was driven crazy by constantly having to listen to animals' conversations. He complained that a walk among the green wood shall become but a fiendish cacophony. The red squirrel upon her branch doth gossip about her neighbors. High in the skies the crows sing bawdy songs, as though one were in some miserable alehouse. And the slugs, as they crawl in mud, I shiver and deign to relate the terrible things of which they speak. Think cows are dumb? Let Aneurin inform you, in Voren's retelling, the cattle are engaged from sunup to midnight in sundry discursions of which would render Aristotle a deaf man, and shall I hear again a heifer pronounce flaws within Plato's proof of the immortality of the soul, I shall wish to seclude myself within the cloisters and never come out. He concluded, I hate all animals but for the human being. Writing centuries later, in his 1597 work Essays, Sir Francis Bacon cited the reference to St. Aneurin in the Golden Legend as evidence that if animals are having detailed conversations all the time, they must be conscious and therefore possible to evangelize. Whatever all the interesting facts blog posts about St. Aneurin may tell you, Bacon clearly meant this only as a thought experiment, as by that point in the Renaissance, nobody believed the stories in the Golden Legend were all true. Bacon was just alluding to something that his educated audience would probably know about. However, Aneurin came to believe that his gift was for the best when he saved the village of Puilguingil, his hometown, from a pard. Not a pard! What is a pard? It's a medieval word for a leopard, and in general, any kind of big cat. What was a big cat doing in medieval Wales? Yeah, exactly, but that's how the story goes. Apparently a pard was ripping through the Welsh kingdom of Gwynedd, eating people and laying towns to waste. The king of Gwynedd, Gruffudd ap Llywelyn, had sent his bravest knights to defeat the pard, and they had been eaten, quote, all with the armor upon. When the pard approached Puilguingil, the townsfolk called upon Aneurin to talk some sense into it, which he only did with great trepidation, reciting a prayer and fearing for his life as he walked up into the hills and kneeled down before the beast. A negotiation with the pard ensued, in which the pard revealed that it was there, quote, because the fine taste of the Welshman is beyond parallel in my native land, to which Aneurin responded that the Welshmen are a tough and toothsome people, far smaller in flavor than the fatted Englishmen. This apparently convinced the pard, and it set off to the east to eat some English people instead. Upon the pard's departure, Aneurin knelt down and thanked God, saying that his faith had been tested by his lifetime of being tortured by all the animals jabbering, and now he understood why he had been given this gift. According to some tellings, he was raptured into heaven then and there. Later retellings of the story of St. Aneurin of Anglesey have him recommending that the pard go in the opposite direction and eat the Irish, sanitizing this tale of a Welsh national hero to curry favor with the English. Quick, what do headaches, rabies, demonic possession, and French people all have in common? St. Denis is the patron saint of all of them. Wait, isn't Joan of Arc the patron saint of the French? Yes, her too. You can have multiple patron saints of the same thing. And Joan of Arc only came to be seen as a French national hero around the time of the French Revolution, and wasn't officially canonized by the Pope until 1920. St. Denis of Paris is the OG. He was a 3rd century Christian martyr and bishop of Paris back in the waning days of the Roman Empire, when the city was still called Lutetia. He was also the most famous, but not the only, saint who is a cephalophore. What, you may ask, is a cephalophore? Well, you probably know what a cephalopod is, the class of animals that includes squid and octopi. You may also know that cephalopod means head foot, because that's pretty much all an octopus is. I think you can assume that St. Denis of Paris was not a squid. Let's try to derive what cephalophore means. It has to do with his head. You know what this is? A lot of you have enough train autism to know what one of these is. It's a type of railroad signal called a semaphore. The angle the flag is at conveys how fast the train is allowed to go. When sailors and the military signal to each other with flags, that's called semaphore code. In fact, any means of visually communicating without words over a distance is a semaphore. Because semaphore means meaning carrier. Sema, like semiotics, and the suffix "-phore," means it carries the thing that precedes it. So cephalophore means head carrier, and that means more or less what you think it means. Maybe. I'm actually not sure what you think it means. It means you carry your head. It means a saint, traditionally depicted in art, walking along headless, carrying their head. Because they're a saint, in the visual language of Catholic art, they have to have a halo. Where does a cephalophoric saint put their halo? Unclear. Here's St. Denis with a halo around his severed head. Here he is with a halo where his head is supposed to be. Denis was sent on a mission from Italy to convert Gaul to Christianity by Pope Fabian. He was appointed as the first bishop of Paris. Apparently, Bishop Denis was so good at spreading the good word and converting pagans that this led the pagan leaders to petition the Roman governor of Gaul to arrest Bishop Denis. The martyrdom of Denis, through beheading, apparently took place at the highest hill in Paris, allegedly once a druidic holy place. Because of Denis, the site became known as Mons Martyrum, Latin for Martyr's Mountain. As Latin transformed into French, the hill came to its present-day name, Montmartre. Denis is also accounted for in the Golden Legend by our Italian chronicler, Jacobus de Varenne, who stated the following. After this, they were presented to the judge and were put again to new torments, and then he did do smite off the heads of the three fellows, that is to say, Denis, Rusticus, and Eleutherius, the other missionaries, in confessing the name of the Holy Trinity. And this was done by the Temple of Mercury, and they were beheaded with three axes. And anon the body of St. Denis raised himself up, and bare his head between his arms, as the angel led him 2 leagues from the place, which is said the Hill of the Martyrs, unto the place where he now resteth, by his election, and by the purveyance of God. There is no record of whether Thriller began playing as he walked down the hill holding his head, but I like to think that it did. St. Denis has now become associated with being the patron saint of the French people, French monarchy, and invoked to stop diseases of the head and mind, ranging from headaches to demonic possession and, yes, rabies. Again, St. Denis isn't the only cephalophore. It's not too rare for saints who were martyred by removing some body part to be depicted ever since carrying that body part. Sometimes it's their head. Other times it's other body parts. In Catania, in Sicily, they have an annual festival of St. Agatha, the city's patron saint. One of the highlights of the festival is the serving of these cupcakes. If these cupcakes look suggestive to you, do not get your mind out of the gutter. That's exactly where it's supposed to be. In fact, if you didn't immediately go, oh, those cupcakes look like boobs, you are stupid and wrong. They are supposed to look like boobs. Am I even allowed to show this on YouTube? These are cupcakes. Nothing to see here. All right, so I don't mean to knock eating boobs as a pastime. You don't need a strong reason to do that. But why are they associated with St. Agatha? Here's her story. She's one of the really early Christian martyrs from the Roman days, which means that her very historicity is disputed. She may have never really existed at all, but here's her account in the Golden Legend. Like many early converts to Christianity, Agatha was the daughter of a well-connected noble family. At age 15, she embraced Christianity and vowed to stay a virgin forever. Believing that this was just teenage rebellion, the prefect Quintianus, governor of the district of Sicily, attempted to secure her hand in marriage. When she rebuffed him repeatedly, Quintianus got so mad that he reported her to the emperor Decius as a Christian. She was sent to a brothel and forced to work as a prostitute, where she still kept her faith. Then she was tortured in various nasty but expected ways, retaining her faith. Most notably, her breasts were torn out with tongs. Agatha was then sentenced to be burned at the stake, but then an earthquake struck Catania, sending the city into chaos and sparing her. She remained in prison, where she was visited by Saint Peter, who healed all her wounds and brought her into heaven. Because of the nastiest detail of the tortures she endured, Saint Agatha is now the patron saint of breast cancer.
I got the results of the test back. I definitely have breast cancer.
Of wet nurses, women whose job it was to breastfeed others' babies, and the biggest reach of all, bell makers, because those have the same shape. Art of her shows her carrying her breasts on a plate. This is why I feel like the Catholic Church has to have a sense of humor about their canonizations. The early saints, at least in the official hagiographies, met their deaths in some of the most horrible ways imaginable, and then they became patron saints of things that read like jokes at the expense of their martyrdom. You get your head cut off, now you're the patron saint of headaches. You get your nipples torn out, now you're the patron saint of badoinkers. Saint Lawrence was grilled to death, according to legend, and is therefore now the patron saint of cooks. You know how I talked about the Grim Reaper earlier? About how he's one of those interesting folklore entities who seem like they would be a religious figure, but aren't? Like, nobody literally believes the Grim Reaper exists, but a historian looking back on our culture from the distant future would think we do. There's a character much more like this. One who is associated with a major Christian holiday, but is not a Christian figure at all. Even though he is basically worshipped and treated like a sort of messiah and embodiment of good in the world. He has unusual attributes befitting an actual god, such as multiple names used as synonyms and world-spanning power. It would be really, really hard to explain to future historians that he wasn't a central figure of any religion, and he was, once, a historical Christian figure. You know who I'm talking about, right? Saint Nicholas was not from the North Pole. He was from present-day Turkey and was ethnically Greek. He, too, lived so early on in the church's history that it's not clear he really existed, and less clear that he really did what his hagiographies say. But he was probably a real person. He is more widely celebrated in the Eastern Orthodox churches these days than in any of the Western sects, other than in his pop culture incarnation, of course. He was born to wealthy parents who died in a plague when Nicholas was young. He spent the rest of his life distributing his parents' inheritance to the needy. The idea of Saint Nicholas bringing gifts to children in the middle of the night has a surprisingly dark origin. Dark-ish, I guess. The surprisingly dark origin of 10 holiday traditions, number 7 will shock you! In his most famous story, Nicholas knew of a Christian family in his village who had once been rich but lost all their money for unspecified bad luck. The father couldn't afford dowries for his 3 daughters, which meant they wouldn't get to be married, and in that time and place there was only one life path for unmarried women, sex work. To save the girls from this fate, Nicholas walked past their house in the middle of the night and threw a bag of gold into the open window. That's the dowry for one girl. The next night, another bag of gold, 2 girls. I'm sure the household was grateful to be spared the decision of which daughter deserves to get married, because by this point they could predict what was going to happen. The father stayed up late on the 3rd night and caught Nicholas throwing the final bag of gold. He told the father to keep his charity a secret, because he didn't want anyone thinking that he was only being charitable to boost his reputation. One of the best stories of the historical Saint Nick, and I am disappointed to have to inform you this one is almost definitely made up, but all of this is probably made up, so whatever. He was defrocked as a priest for getting physical at the Council of Nicaea. Crash course on the Council of Nicaea. The first Council of Nicaea, held in the year 325 AD, was a conference that united all the leaders of the newly powerful and growing Christian religion to basically hash out exactly what Christians were supposed to believe. The most important and divisive question on the agenda was, when Jesus said he was the Son of God, how are we supposed to interpret that? There were 2 main schools of thought. Trinitarianism, which holds that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are one and the same as 3 incarnations of God, and Arianism, which holds that Jesus was a separate entity created by God that hadn't always existed alongside God. As you probably know from the familiarity of the phrase, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, which is probably recognizable even in non-Christian countries, Trinitarianism won out, and Arianism is no longer really believed by any significant Christian sect, other than possibly the Jehovah's Witnesses, and even the Jehovah's Witnesses don't identify with Arianism. It also doesn't have anything to do with Hitler. Different spelling of Arian. But in the early days, both ideologies were in open conflict, and it wasn't clear if Christians would ever agree on it. Saint Nicholas was one of the strongest supporters of Trinitarianism, which may be why many things in his hagiography come in threes. There are 2 separate stories of him saving 3 children, one of which I haven't told yet. According to a story that first gained prominence over 1,000 years later, when St. Nicholas attended the Council of Nicaea, he got so heated in his defense of Trinitarianism that he slapped or even punched a supporter of Arianism, possibly its originator, the philosopher Arius himself. This led to Emperor Constantine revoking Nicholas's priesthood. It's also not the only story of St. Nicholas coming to blows with someone. There's another popular medieval tale that has him beating up a too strict abbot for not allowing the monks in his monastery to sing songs. Despite the yawning gap of time between when these stories supposedly happened and when they were first attested, some historians have said the real St. Nick must have had a tendency for fisticuffs because of the criterion of embarrassment. The criterion of embarrassment is a concept that originated in studies of Christian saints, but it's very useful as a tool when studying history in general. Basically, everyone who records history has their biases, of course, and if someone they're trying to depict in a positive light does something bad or stupid, that probably really happened, because why would they make something up that would embarrass their hero? The very word hagiography is more often used today as a metaphor than a literal term for a biography of a saint to mean a historical account that unfairly sanitizes a complicated historical figure. Plenty of actual hagiographies are like that, of course, but what's more interesting are the ones that aren't. The St. Nicholas stories get weirder. This one is gruesome, and is also part of the reason St. Nick is associated with saving children. Number 7 will shock you! According to medieval Europeans' favorite legend of Nicholas, during a famine, a butcher kidnapped 3 children, chopped them up, and put their remains in a barrel to be sold as ham. St. Nick came into the butcher's shop, looking for the missing kids, and made the sign of the cross over the barrel where they were curing, which reconstituted the meat into living children. This was a very popular story in medieval Europe, depicted in tapestries and stained glass windows all the time. Sometimes all you needed to show was a man next to a barrel, and people would know, yes, that's St. Nick. According to some historians, over time this story passed out of common knowledge because it's incredibly weird and gross, but the visual symbolism of St. Nicholas standing next to a barrel or 3 children outlived it, even if people didn't remember the reason why he's depicted like this, so they assumed that he was the patron saint of brewers or of children, both of which he now is. He was also the patron saint of sailors, because he did a lot of sailing around the Eastern Mediterranean in his day, which led to widespread celebrations of St. Nicholas in seafaring countries like the Netherlands, where St. Nicholas translates to Sinterklaas. During the Renaissance, the Dutch celebrated St. Nicholas Day on December 6th, with parades honoring sailors and gifts given to children, because that was what St. Nick did. The Dutch influence in New York led to the commemoration of Sinterklaas spreading across America, being integrated with Christmas, and the name Sinterklaas gradually morphing into Santa Claus. At least we didn't borrow the other important part of the Dutch commemoration of St. Nicholas, the blackface part. In the Netherlands, to this day, Santa doesn't have elves. His assistant is this guy. There are many, many more unusual saints. In fact, on a hypothetical iceberg chart of the weirdest saints, I think all 9 saints I went over are above the waterline. Except the one I made up! Remember, one of these is fake. Make your guesses, but if you comment which one you think it is, hide your comment behind a bunch of paragraph breaks so people don't scroll down and automatically see it. But they're all fake, sort of, and they all speak to the human spirit nonetheless. It's possible that some of the things discussed in this video may have historically occurred just as they're told, but most didn't. And does it matter? This is a fully formed mythology right under our noses, as colorful and strange and instructive to the human condition as Greek or Egyptian mythology. Why aren't there more YA novels with saints as the characters rather than Greek gods? The answer is obviously that saints belong to a religion that's still powerful and widely practiced. You're not gonna offend that many people if you write about the Greek gods. Still, all these archetypes are universal. All of these make for great stories, and I think it's interesting that educated Westerners are more likely to be aware of pre-Christian mythologies than equally bountiful Christian ones. Let's add All Saints' Day back into the secular calendar, not as something solemn and penitent, but as a day to celebrate and retell the stories we've told about ourselves, and the way these stories have taken on lives of their own and wormed their way into other mythologies, like with the syncretic saints of Latin America. Let's celebrate the weird and wonderful stories of cephalophores, cured children in multiple ways, titty cupcakes, flying aspies, pard encounters, and the gay Mexican skeleton Virgin Mary. To overcome an obstacle or an enemy, to dominate the impossible in our life.